This is a PlanetPhilip.com podcast.
Hello and welcome to another Planet Philip podcast. Today's podcast is the tree podcast for episode one, and joining me is Don. Hello, Don.
Hi, Philip. How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine, thanks. And you?
Good, thank you.
Are you finding it hard to game when the sun's out? Are you kind of got this guilty, you know, devil demon on one side saying, game, game, and then like the angel saying, go outside.
Sometimes it's actually, it can be pretty hot here. I'm in the east coast of the U.S. and mm-hmm. we had a week stretch back in July where it was just brutal outside. You did 95 degrees plus. I'm not sure what that is in Celsius. It's 35 or so, I think, but it's almost unbearable outside. So sometimes, but, you know, I also had a big vacation way back in February, so I don't mind playing games while it's hot out. How about you?
Yeah, no, it's no problem for me. In Spain, what we have is everybody has shutters, and they're the kind of like roller shutters, and they're on every window, so you can roll them down, and the house becomes completely black, so that when it does get hot, you put those down in the morning. You keep them down and the house doesn't get particularly hot. We're starting to get air conditioning here, but most people don't have it. So if I can't see the sun, I can't feel guilty. So I'm quite happy about that release.
It's a good way to convince yourself. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And of course, the dark room makes better for gaming. I mean, that's clear. So, all right. So let's talk about episode one. I mean, the first thing that we really want to talk about is our background with it. I mean, we always joke, you and I, about how many times you've played Half-Life and Half-Life 2. And just to start with, this was my second playthrough of episode one. But what about you? How many for you?
I think it's probably about my fourth total. I think I played once right before episode two came out. It's sort of that would have been my second playthrough of this one. And then once the achievements were added, I didn't go through and get all the achievements, but I did replay it again somewhere in the interim, and then this would have been number four. So, actually, not that frequently, at least for me. You know, you play things only once or twice all the way through, but, you know, maybe it's not setting records for Half-Life and Half-Life 2, but I know them, you know, pretty well. So,
yeah. Okay. And what were your initial thoughts? I mean, you played it. Actually, my question was going to be, have you now completed all of the achievements?
No.
This playthrough?
No, I can't remember. There's a couple left. I should look up what I have left. I actually got the one bullet achievement back when I actually played for the achievements. I played for that, which is you can only shoot one bullet, I think, in the entire game. And that's to break the lock early on was it Low Life? One of the early chapters. You have to shoot a padlock off of the door. And you can't even do it with the gravity gun. So that's literally the only bullet you can shoot for this achievement in the entire game. You can use grenades, rocket launchers, gravity gun. That has to be your only bullet fired. So.
Okay. All right. That's pretty impressive. That must be a difficult one. Maybe one of the hardest. I don't know, maybe the gnome from the episode two might be the hardest one of all of the achievements. But that one is pretty difficult.
Yeah, and it's, you know, honestly, I don't really like those type of achievements very much. I'd much rather see ones that maybe you don't really get during normal gameplay, but it doesn't take up, you know, it doesn't change your entire game, which, you know, this one free bullet or whatever it's called, really does change the way you play. You consciously can't use your shotgun, which is a great weapon in Half-Life, in episode one, I'm sorry. Or the pistol, which you may use at long range. So it kind of limits your... I mean, yes, it adds some replay value, perhaps, but it's a little artificial, I think. And I'm kind of walking a fence on achievements. Some of them are fun, and some of them are kind of annoying. And that's kind of why I've never tried to get that gnome achievement in episode two. I think that's just too much to ask, honest.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm more on the fence of I'm not really a fan of the achievements, but that's probably because I don't replay the games very often. Mm. And if you play only once, and I think if you try and do all of the achievements on only one playthrough, then maybe you're missing the general. You're focused on achievements and not seeing the fun part of the game. And in fact, I don't know whether you can do all achievements in one playthrough. I mean, if you did the one free bullet, are there some other achievements that perhaps you can't do? I don't know. Maybe not.
Possibly. I'm looking at them now, and the other ones that I don't have are like, kill five enemies with the same energy ball, or kill a soldier with his own energy ball. Those are all okay because you can still use the gravity gun.
And
the flares on the zombies, that type of thing. So which I don't think these are mutually exclusive, but in some games or some situations they would be. You can't. This, some of these may demand multiple playthroughs. I can't think of any examples offhand, but I'm not sure if episode 2 is like that or not.
It's interesting. Now, I'm looking at the same time, and I see that I don't have one of them. In fact, it says I've unlocked 3 from 13. But one of them is containment, contain the Citadel core. And it says I don't have that, but I finished the game, so I must have done that.
Right.
Surely.
Yeah, my only thought is maybe you inadvertently have SV cheats on... set to 1, for no clipping or to get screenshots or whatever. If that's the case, then it won't record achievements, even if you do.
Oh, okay. I don't remember doing any of that to take screenshots.
Well, it may be in your setup. I don't know. You'd have to... Yeah, and it's not,
But then it wouldn't show... Anyway.
Steam is not the most bug-free of programs either, so,
I mean, this is one of the problems, isn't it? If you spend a long time trying to do something and then it doesn't show the achievement...
Oh, can you imagine that with the gnome? Oh, my God.
Or you get it to the end. Actually, there is a cheat that you can do to... You can get there and you can spawn something and then you change its name and you call it a gnome and you put it inside and you get the achievement, apparently. But, yeah, if you had spent the whole game playing it and then you didn't get it... That would be pretty frustrating, I think. Wow. All right, so as we normally say, let's start at the end. You've played it 4 times. I've played it twice. How do we feel about it?
Well, I think I enjoyed it more than I expected to this time around. I think in general, episode 1 kind of gets a bad rap, at least in the Source Engine games that Valve has released, not just even Half-Life 2 and Episode 2, but you look at the other games, like in the Orange Box, and Episode 1 can't quite hold its own against most of those. But in its own right, it's still a pretty enjoyable game. It's, I think, if I had to sum it up in a nutshell, and I think James Partridge made this case on one of the posts on the website there, is that Episode 1 really takes the elements of Half-Life 2 and polishes them up and combines them in interesting ways. And I think it doesn't do much new and groundbreaking, but what it does, it does really well. And it's really a nice contained experience that maybe is only a few hours worth of gameplay. And I think that was one of the criticisms, is that for the cost, whatever it was, $20 at the time, you only get a few hours of gameplay. But,
I'm
a big fan of those types of experiences. I'm willing to pay more for a nice, tight, focused experience, not a 100-plus hour open world type of game that you can really get absorbed in. They have their merits, too, but it's just not my cup of tea. So.
Yeah. I have to agree with you, and I probably want to say publicly that I was wrong. I mean, I remember having a quite a negative feeling about episode 1, and it is a good game. There's no doubt about it, but I think it suffers from context. I think that when I played it, it was not long before I played episode 2. So I think I made a comparison with episode 2 quite quickly as well. But also, it's easy to compare it to Half-Life 2. And Half-Life 2 is approximately 4 times as long.
Mm.
So suddenly, you've got this huge difference. Half-Life 2 was so different from the last game, which was Blue Shift. So we had this huge difference here. And then suddenly, Episode 1 comes along, and it is. It's a tight game. It does some things very well. There's some things I don't like, but that's going to be the same with everything. But it's just kind of in the middle. It's in the middle between Half-Life 2, which was revolutionary. It was long. it doesn't really contain anything new, and then suddenly episode two comes along and it's new and it really tells the story much further, you know, bing bang bosh, and it's like in the middle of those things, and in context it doesn't stand out, but on its own it's a good game.
Yeah, I agree.
And I don't know, maybe if I were to try and look at it as objectively as possible, there are some things that it does much better than Half-Life 2. As you mentioned, you know, James said it was more polished in some areas. But that length thing is a big problem, if you make the comparison.
Yeah, it is, but at the same time, we're trying to judge, you know, admittedly, one part of a larger, not just a story arc, but one part of, you know, one episode out of three was the original plan, and who knows what Valve is up to now, but so it's very hard to divorce it from Half-Life 2 and Episode 2 when, you know, nowadays if you play them as a whole or back to back, yeah, maybe one of the weaker chapters, but it really serves its purpose pretty well. It moves the storyline a little bit forward. It sets up a lot of stuff in episode two, a ton of stuff.
It does.
You know, oh yeah, I mean, we get previews of the advisors, you get a quick preview of the hunter, you know, I don't know if you really get a sense that Alex is going to be in trouble in the next episode, but the G-Man doesn't really show up much at all in episode one. He's, you know, you could say thwarted by the Vortigaunts in the opening opening scene of episode one. And we don't see him again until that really memorable scene in episode two when the Vortigaunts are actually healing Alex. While he's not a big part of... G-Man isn't a big part of episode one. It serves to move the player and Alex out of City 17 and show really what happens to the Citadel. And, you know, in that, I don't know, payment of the story, it does a really good job, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Now, ignore the phone in the background, sorry. I can't reach it to turn it off. One of the things I was doing just before we came on air was that I was looking through all of the screenshots, and one of the things that struck me was that there's this blue-orange thing going on, especially at the beginning when you go into the Citadel. There's a lot of orange there, and there's a lot of orange a bit later, and there's a lot of blue, but generally it's not a bright... looking game. It's quite dull, and it doesn't, I mean, there's some of the areas when you think about Half-Life 2, you know, the beach area and some of the other areas, they're bright, they really seem to show off the Source engine. And I almost get the feeling that Valve were saying, look, we don't need to show you how cool it can look, we need to show you how the cool things it can do.
Yeah. Sorry.
No,
I think the key is, you know, you're looking at the color palette of the game, and I think they, again, you sort of have to compare it to what came before and after, like you just did. You know, if you think of episode two, for those that have played it, it's actually quite a bit of bright open skies, and, you know, there is some mine tunnel crawling and whatnot too. But episode one is, I don't say monochromatic, but you're right, it's got a very set tone. It's dark. It's maybe a little. It's got overtones of red and orange in a lot of the scenes, which give you almost like an impending doom. And I think that's very intentional. You know, if you think through the Citadel playthrough at the end of Half-Life 2, it was all very blue and pale blue lights, and it had a very cold feeling. You know, it was often gray metal with blue lighting on it, and that gave you a certain type of feeling, and I think they intentionally contrasted that in episode one, when you're in the Citadel and things are falling apart. They wanted to change the color palette intentionally to contrast the pale blue lighting, like we'd previously seen, with the dark reds and oranges of fire and heat and an unstable core and that type of thing. And it really gives you the feeling that the Citadel isn't, you always got the feeling it was never quite right, even when you were in it in Half-Life 2. It wasn't human. But this really gives you the idea that it's something is wrong with it. And, you know, of course, at the end of episode one, it goes away. But I think it does well to convey that through sort of by not telling you to your face. It just gives you that feeling that, you know, things are falling apart. Things are different.
Yeah. Things are different. Okay, so let's go through chapter by chapter. So the first chapter is Undue Alarm. And this is where you wake up. Where you have a little story, not a story so much, but you have like a little intro video. You see the G-Man, you see the Vortigaunts, you see Alex just before the explosion, as it were, and then suddenly you wake up at the bottom of the Citadel. And that was quite a nice start. I wasn't really sure how we were going to continue. And, you know, Alex is a little bit coy and, oh, gee, oh, Gordon, you're okay. Oh, I'm so happy. You know, that kind of thing. And then we get a little bit of storytelling because we figure out, you know, Dr. Kleiner says, oh, thank goodness you're not anywhere near the Citadel because it's about to blow. And he's like, actually, we're at the bottom. Okay. So, I mean, that's like a nice start. And then suddenly we're thrown into the Citadel. I mean, do you remember that, the first time you played it? I was so impressed with that.
Yeah, I was, you know, of course, Half-Life 2 ended with a bit of a cliffhanger, and I'm glad they didn't do, like, a recap of Half-Life 2, but they picked up right where it ended. You know, they showed how Alex could have plausibly survived the explosion at the top of the Citadel. They don't really explain how you get down there, but I'm willing to overlook that. You know, you're wearing a pretty strong HEV suit, I suppose. So,
yeah.
But it didn't go so far as to, you know, do the, you know, on our last episode, this is what happened, which episode 2 opens with, and I wasn't a big fan of that. But
yeah, I noticed in your comment today that you didn't like that very
much. I guess that was kind of, you know, that was sold with the orange box, so I suppose maybe it was necessary for people who hadn't played episode 1, if anybody existed out there that hadn't, but I don't know. But anyway, we're talking about episode 1. So, you know, I thought what was most memorable about that opening chapter here is not just the toss into the Citadel by Dog, which I thought was kind of fun, but it was how, and this goes back to what I was just saying, how different everything looks. You know, you're literally the first view you have once Dog gets out of your view line there is that you're staring up into at the top of the Citadel and the big storm going on up there, and everything's cloudy and red, and fire is lightning is spewing out of the top of the Citadel, and I remember that being an impressive shot. You know, that was a perfect opening shot. I mean, Valve very intentionally did this. But I still didn't feel too manipulated in it. In other words, they weren't doing a cutscene, so to speak. They were just having you know, sort of a locked view for a couple of seconds just to make sure that the player knew what was going on above them. Because, you know, it's a big challenge, actually, in first-person game design, is how do you get the player to look up at something? It's actually quite a bit more difficult than you'd think to actually attract the player's attention upward above sort of, you know, more or less level ground.
Yeah, thank goodness for the crows.
Yeah, so this was a great way to do it, was to have the player looking up to start, and then have Alex start her talk and see Dog and all that stuff. So
yeah, and I mean, they'd used that before. They'd used it in Half-Life 2 after you get beaten up by the three Metro cops, and then suddenly you're looking at Alex.
Right.
So I mean, it felt quite natural because we'd had it before. You know, lying on the ground, that seems quite normal. I mean, if you fell off somewhere, you'd normally lie on the ground rather than stand straight up. And you're right, and they used it to their advantage to show you the effect of what happened when you blew up the core,
right,
as it were.
Right.
Well, not the core, but the whatever it was called, I can't remember.
Yeah, reactor or something, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And then you're working your way through the Citadel, and of course there's lots of noises and it's creaking and there's, you know, flashes of sparks, and some things work and some things don't. And then we get to this huge area, which is like the orange area. I don't know what the name of that part of the Citadel is, but it's the orange area. But do you remember that particular part?
Yeah, it's sort of, you get the sense it's filled with dust and or fire, I guess. And that, again, goes back to sort of the orange and red color contrast to the cool blue that we're used to in the Citadel. And
yeah,
I think that, you know, more than anything, I think they try to set up in the first couple of maps in this chapter, how off kilter the and how unstable the Citadel has become. And to give you really a plausible mission in the next chapter is to kind of, in a funny way, invert what you did in the, at the end of Half-Life 2, right? At the end of Half-Life 2, you were trying to destroy the reactor in the Citadel. Now, at the second chapter, you're kind of trying to save the core in the Citadel so it doesn't blow up while you're, you know, 20 feet away from it. So.
Yeah, exactly. And then this chapter ends with you going down on that large lift, which I thought was a really nice piece of gameplay, because instead of just getting you to go down to the bottom, which I suppose they could have done with a lift anyway, or a drop, or a slide, you have to protect yourself from going down in that lift. And I found it quite difficult, but I thought that was a really nice, not mechanic, because it's not exactly a mechanic, but it's a nice use of the structure itself, which we know is very vertical. But you're stationary on the platform, but you're still moving, and you've got to use the gravity gun. I really like that part.
Yeah, me too. And it didn't go on too long, thankfully. You know, it was it was just enough. You have the elevator start and stop a couple times, and you have to restart it with those little energy balls from the combine. But it was just about the right length for me. It was maybe 3 or 4 minute length, a couple of stops,
yeah, it was.
And it wasn't so brief that you didn't remember it, and it wasn't too long that it annoyed you, I thought. So
no, absolutely. Did you die? I died a couple of times.
Not this time around. I was pretty careful. I learned it's actually better to catch those things with the gravity gun than it is just to try to punt them away with the gravity gun. So.
Oh, I never tried punting. I always caught them. Oh, okay. I thought that's what I was supposed to do.
Yeah. Well, it's. I found it easier to do that, but I think it got me the first couple times I played it. But this time I did okay. And it's interesting. You almost see shades of some of the design that went into Portal a year or two later. You see some of those early ideas show up here in Episode 1. With directing the energy balls into
energy
the right
balls.
Sockets. I mean, it's not, in a way, it's really just a switch at a distance. You know, in other words, you have to get tab A into slot B. But at the same time, the graphics, now that we've all played Portal, of course, now the graphics and some of the sounds, of course, are identical to Portal. And it's interesting to see maybe some of the early ideas creeping in.
No, you're right. I never really considered that. And then that leads us on to the next chapter, which is called Direct Intervention. And this is where we actually have to save, I'm not even sure what they're calling it. What is it called?
It's the core.
The reactor.
Is this the reactor?
Is the reactor? No.
Who knows?
Reactor's containment system.
Okay.
All right, okay. So that's what Combine Overwiki is calling it. So and this was quite fun. I mean, there was certainly a lot of action. This is where you have to get inside. Okay, yeah, and then you can kill some of the stalkers, but you don't have to if you don't want to.
It's more or less to make your way to. I think it's three containment
points.
Beams, right? And then that will stabilize the core. And what I liked about this was that it was mostly, of course, a puzzle-oriented chapter. You have only the gravity gun, but it is the super gravity gun at this point, for most of this chapter. So again, it harkens back to the end of Half-Life 2, when you were in the Citadel and you got the supercharged gun. But I'm glad that they threw in some combat. You know, there's quite a few Combine soldiers that come and try to thwart your efforts here, but...
Yeah.
You're almost overpowered at this point. So it's much more of a puzzle level than it is a combat level, I found. And,
yes.
And I thought that suited the gameplay well, in that it doesn't just throw you in. Yes, you're up against some of the toughest enemies in the game right here, but you also have the best weapon in the game to start with. So it was a little bit of another inversion of our typical, a typical advancement where you find the crowbar first, then you find a pistol, and then,
Yeah.
So I kind of like the way this started out and then reverse things after this chapter. You know, you still have the gravity gun. It's no longer supercharged, but you quickly get other weapons as you're facing some of the easier enemies in the next chapter.
Yeah. I mean, it's true. It's almost a reversal. Half-Life 2, you had the super gravity gun and you destroy the reactor. Episode one, you're saving the reactor and you start with the weapon that you almost finished with in the last chapter.
Right.
It's kind of, the symmetry there is quite nice. My only criticism is that I would have liked it to have been timed, in the sense that what would have happened if I just hung around?
Yeah, I don't know, though, because if you listen to the commentary, they don't specifically talk about timing, but if you listen to the developer's commentary, which anybody who's very interested in game design or really likes Half-Life 2 Episode 1 and Episode 2, I highly recommend listening to the developer's commentary as you play through, maybe, not the first time, certainly, but after you've played it once or twice. You get to see how they approach things and you get an idea feel for some of the early ideas that were later rejected after playtesting. And one of them was not a timer per se, but it was more urgency from Alex. They often had her leading you through the various paths and tunnels, not necessarily in this core section per se, but to get to the core, she had early versions of Episode 1 had her kind of almost bugging the player, like, hurry up, what are you doing, what are you waiting for, we have to go. And they found that playtesters more or less got annoyed with Alex, being around her more than 30 seconds, which is understandable. So
yes, it
they
is.
Made the deliberate decision to let the player move at their own pace, even in this so-called, urgent situation. Because it is still pretty dangerous. I don't know if anything happens if you wait around for 15 minutes or not, but you get the sense that it will. And I think that's kind of the important
part. That's enough, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. And then the chapter finishes with, I don't know, perhaps the scariest part of all of the game so far for me, which is the Razor Train. And I'm not sure why I say it's scary, but the part once it's crashed and you've got the Stalker screaming at Alex, I mean, I found that quite, not disturbing. I mean, I'm not 7 years old, but it was, it's the first time that you really see, close-up potential danger from this type of creature. And it's, that scream is pretty scary, really.
Yeah, it was pretty
intense.
And I
don't think you can do anything. You can't do anything, can you? At first, you can't, or can you?
I think the only thing you can is what you have to do, is use the gravity gun to get that Stalker away from Alex.
But do you have that initially?
I don't know.
I can't remember.
Yeah.
My screenshot doesn't show me with a gravity gun.
Oh, you definitely have it there, because it takes place after.
Yeah, but I don't seem to have the screen. Maybe my screenshots. Going back to this achievements thing, I think maybe I did go and I took off the HUD and the I did Impulse 200.
Yep, and the weapon, right? So they don't show. Yep.
And that's why my achievements didn't show up.
Yes,
okay.
Yes, indeed.
All right, yeah. But I just remember initially thinking, what am I going to do? How am I going to help her? And then, of course, eventually you fire with the gravity gun and you get her off her. But
yeah. It was a bit of intense few seconds there, because you wake up from that crash and there's one in your face, too. And then you make your way down and you find out Alex has kind of been pinned there. Although, from seeing them earlier in this chapter, they've been mostly passive. They don't threaten you directly. They kind of try to foil your efforts to keep the portals open or keep the light bridge on by overriding it. So sometimes you have to get rid of them, but they don't seem to pose a direct threat. And I think she's more creeped out than anything and angry at what did these to the, I guess Stalkers are former humans, I suppose, right?
I suppose, yeah.
So that gives you an idea of what really may be behind some of the Combine, hatred and technology, let's say. So.
Yeah. And then that chapter leads into Low Life, which is probably my least favorite.
Definitely my least favorite.
And, the interesting thing here is that you actually took longer to complete this than I did. And that's really unusual. There's not very many levels in any of the games that we've played where you took longer than I did. But you took 33 minutes.
Yeah, and I wonder why that is. I don't particularly remember.
According to my screenshots, I only took 19 minutes, which is how I do my timings. I take a screenshot at the beginning, I take a screenshot at the end, and then I just look at the difference in time. Mm. That's my timings. So maybe my timing was wrong. I don't know.
I do remember it took me, several minutes of wandering around to find that power switch that turned on the turned the lights on in the elevator. Not the lights, but turn the elevator back on. You remember when you walk up to the elevator? This is the end of Low Life. You walk up to the elevator, it's lit up, and then the lights go out, and you have to kind of trace the wire along the ceiling. For some reason, I didn't remember at all where that door was, and I totally missed it. And I wandered that whole area for about 4 or 5 minutes. So maybe that probably contributed to my overall playtime. But
yeah, I could have done.
I do also remember killing myself with a couple of explosive barrels inadvertently.
Okay, bad luck.
These things happen. I mean, you know?
It does. I mean, this chapter's got two basic elements. It's got that main element of the larger car park, where you know your objective is to cover the holes to stop the antlions coming out.
I actually really like that section.
That's not a bad section. A bit later on, I feel as though it gets a bit repetitive with covering the antlion holes. But yeah, at the beginning, it's nice. And they can fly up, but you have to go around the ramps and then across the walkways and stuff. So yeah, that is quite a nice section. I definitely died at least once there. And normally when I die, that means that I'm enjoying it. Because if I don't die, then it's probably too easy. Mm. Because I play on easy anyway. Do you follow me?
Yep. Yeah, I do.
Makes sense. So, I mean, if I played on hard, I'd probably die in every location. But anything that I die on in easy, okay, maybe this is more interesting. And then there's the point where you were just talking about, where you have to find a light switch and you've got to wait for the elevator to come down. I hated that part.
Yeah, you know, they repeat this idea of sort of holding out until the ridiculously slow elevator arrives. They repeat this several times in episode 2, and I think it's much, much better there than it is here. Yeah. And that is mainly because of the darkness. Now, I realize why it's done, and it adds, you know, a certain element of anxiety and fear almost. But I found it more frustrating than anything. And not just in that last part, but as you're getting up to that part, they seem to almost bend the rules of how your flashlight works. And I thought that I felt like it was so artificial. I felt like they were just, yeah, why can't we just have a brightly lit scary level for once? You know, I mean, yeah. It was. I found it more frustrating than anything else, and I thought the game was just like cheating a little bit there, and that annoyed me. I do like the idea of, you know, defend this area until your elevator arrives in general, but like I said, I think it's much better executed in the next episode than this one.
Agreed. This one's just too artificial. Yeah. The lights go out and suddenly, here come the zombies.
Yeah.
It just, you know, I mean, I'm sure people, you know, liked it, or some people liked it the very first time they played it, but I think I hated it more this time than I did the first time, and I certainly didn't enjoy it the first time.
Yeah. So, you could make the argument that you're mainly facing weaker enemies here, which is true. I mean, you're facing the zombies, let's be honest, you know, are slow moving. Even the fast zombies are really not that much of a threat. They're more bark than bite, if I can say so. They're very, you know, fast and screaming, but they don't really do that much damage to you up close.
Yeah.
But with the addition of the Zombines,
yeah,
that has really made, you know, some of these end sections of this chapter very dangerous, because as soon as they pull out that grenade, if they're right next to you and you don't, you know, swat it away from them with the gravity gun, you're going down for the count. And I was, you know, victim of that for at least 2 or 3 times here too. So
yeah. So then eventually the elevator goes up and we get outside, when it's the first time we've been outside in effect for a little while, because we've been in the Citadel, then we were in the train, then we were in the car park, then we were underground waiting for the lift, and finally we get out. And in many ways it's a more impressive view than some of the Half-Life 2 views. But it comes back to this brown and reds and dark and depressing, whereas some of the Half-Life 2s were like almost picture postcard. You know, you could like take some screenshots and say, wow, I wish I was on holiday here. This looks really nice.
Right, and I think it's the contrast that's important. You know, they count on people having remembered the view of the Citadel against the bright blue sky, you know, an otherwise very dark, imposing structure. And they contrast it with this view of, it's clearly falling apart. It's the sky is all dusty and maybe full of fallout or something. It looks like it's snowing in, you know, as you play through this section outside. So the definite contrast you get between this and the state of City 17 from Half-Life 2 is really what they wanted to highlight. And that's why you get that view, that perfect view of the Citadel right as you're walking up the stairs from the top of the elevator, if you remember that. You find the little crank handle to open the gate. You turn the corner.
Open the gate.
Yeah. And right up the stairs there is a perfect view of the Citadel again with the fire at the top and then swirling clouds. I thought that was... It was very well done. I mean, they purposely highlighted the Citadel in a number of occasions in this episode, much like they did in Half-Life 2, of course. But here it serves a little different purpose in that it's not just your final goal, but it's clearly, you know, having more problems, even though you just fixed the core again. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And also maybe reminding you that perhaps you're partly responsible for this.
Partly, yes.
yeah, I mean, I'm sure stuff would have happened if you hadn't been there, but it wouldn't have been the same. And, you know, look what you've done.
Yeah.
That's really what Valve are trying to tell you, you know.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Whether you take that in a positive way, like, yay, you know, you've started to free us, or shit, you know, you've really caused a lot of trouble here. they're highlighting that. And I say, in many ways, this is my favourite chapter of this game. It's not my favourite section, but as a complete chapter, if I had to replay any one chapter, this would be it. And one of the reasons is the section with Alex, who is sniping for you.
Mm.
I really like the way they did that. And it changed the way that whole area worked, because you could have easily had Alex following you and you could have built exactly the same level, but suddenly she was behind you. And I really felt part of a team here more than any other time in the game. I was drawing the enemies to her, because I love it when she shoots them, because it's a one-shot, one-kill with her.
Yeah, yeah.
With the sniper rifle. So I thought that section was really well done.
Yeah, I'm pretty much with you there. They tried to build this teamwork a little bit in the previous chapter in Low Life, when you only had the gravity gun and a flashlight. And she was, of course, well-armed, so she kept telling you, you know, direct your flashlight onto the zombies while she shoots them. So there was a little bit of cooperative play there, although, of course, your flashlight can only stay on for, you know, it seems like 30 seconds. It's probably longer than that, but which led to part of the frustration in Low Life. But here,
and of course,
here again, I like how it's sort of inverted, right? You know, you're typically the one avoiding the sniper and staying away from that laser sight as best as you can. And now that Alex has it, you're trying to lead everybody into the path of the laser sight and have her shoot them for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do enjoy the urban settings. I think one of the parts from episode Half-Life 2 that I enjoyed was much more the urban settings, because it seems to give me still a linear feel. I mean, I've got to go here and I've got to go this way. But the combat is behind you. It's above you. Sometimes it's below you. You have to go forward, but now you can't go back. And I got some of that from this level. You know, you're having to run around. And you meet a couple of rebels, and they take you in, and they show you around. And in this particular chapter, you also get the crowbar back.
Yeah, finally.
Yeah, finally. And consider we're halfway through the game, it's... you know, quite interesting. And it's Barney that gives you it.
Yeah.
So we've got this symmetry again with Half-Life 2. You know, he gave it to you in the first Half-Life 2, and now you sort of get it back here. Do you actually need it? Are there times when it was useful? I can't even remember using it,
well,
to be honest.
Well, you know, if you notice that right after you get the crowbar and cross the footbridge there, there's a head crab in the stairway right in front of you. So they give you, or maybe even two. So I think they give you two head, like normal head crabs, not poison or anything. They give you two head crabs to swat with a crowbar just to kind of get back in the feel of Half-Life, you know?
Yeah. So. But I mean, ultimately, you don't really need it.
No, I find the crowbar the most useful, honestly, against the poison head crabs. Because even though you have to get up close to hit them, I think it's one shot, one kill on those guys. So,
yeah.
Which is really nice because I hate them.
And then that leads eventually to the attic area, which I suppose is, you know, pretty spectacular in its own way.
Yeah, we had actually earlier in this chapter, there was a bit of a mini boss fight, if you will, at least a combat, you know, highlight with the Antlion Guard. And yes, we've seen them before in Half-Life 2. I think this was a little different, and again, sort of a little, as we mentioned when we opened this discussion, sort of a twist on the gameplay that we've seen from Half-Life 2. Here we have an Antlion Guard out in an arena area which you can't escape, but we also have a number of Combine soldiers, and even like a little Combine APC, the vehicle that quickly gets smashed by the guard. But that combination, the Antlion Guard, Combine soldiers, and you actually have a couple of Antlion nests, or the holes in the ground that keep spawning Antlions, makes for a little bit more intense and you know, a little bit different gameplay than just when you meet the Antlion in the showers in Nova Prospect, for example.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I'm looking through my screenshots, and I don't seem to have recorded any screenshots. Oh, yeah, I did later on here. This is where you have to jump down, don't you?
Yeah.
Jump down.
Yeah, you jump down from the I guess, whatever building you were in with the Combine outpost and armory. And it's sort of in like an big L-shaped arena section that you can't escape, like I said, until everything's dead.
No, that's right.
So it's pretty wide open. There's, of course, a number of convenient explosive barrels around for you to toss to the Antlion Guard. And there's plenty of room to run. But I thought the combination of enemies there was very well done and added, you know, amped up the combat a little bit, but really added an element of, well, I'm running 5 feet from this Combine soldier. Do I shoot him or do I just keep running? Decision-making.
He's shooting the Antlion.
Right.
Will I just let him do that and, you know, kill him when he's run out of ammo? Or, yeah, true. I think I rushed through that one quite quickly. I'm not really a big fan of Antlion Guards in the sense that I don't enjoy fighting them. Hmm. Nobody's a fan of them, but, you know, in a sense.
The Antlion part.
Yeah, so we're up to the attic, and of course we have this dramatic gunship that we have to take down with the rocket launcher. Now, this is probably going to sound really strange, but this is the first time Alex swears, and it depends really on how you define swearing. But she says Jesus, which I thought was quite an interesting choice of words, because they've managed to sort of keep away any swearing out of it. And I know that, you know, in the list of swear words, Jesus isn't like a huge one, but it surprised me.
I honestly didn't even notice. But yeah, that doesn't catch my attention as much as the more colorful words, let's say. So
yeah, but there is no swearing in Half-Life, is there? I mean, besides Barney, which is bleaked out. Yeah, tell Breen to go himself.
Right.
I mean, anyway. It was, you know, it caught my attention, and it's quite a nice area. I didn't enjoy it so much the first time. I think I enjoyed it more the second time, actually, because I knew what was coming and I could not plan for it, but I could play it for what it was. Whereas the first time it was like, oh shit, what am I gonna do? And maybe I wasn't as good a player as I am now. Not that I'm a good player, but. I don't know. For you, better or worse this time around?
It was a little tougher because this time I played on hard. And on hard, the striders and the gunships take about 6 or 7 rockets to take down. So which, you know, can drag on and on, especially when you're not sure if you hit them once or twice. You think you did, but you're not sure. It can, they can be tough battles, let's say. So I still had trouble with this one. This took me a few tries to get through, but all in all, I really liked this battle. I thought it was, you know, given that it's an enemy that we're very familiar with because we've fought several of them in Half-Life 2, at least 4 that I can think of, probably more like 6 or 7. Mm-hmm. But it's a little, again, it's sort of a twist. You're in a trapped area, so you can't really do much except take cover and weave back and forth. And the environment changes the further you go. Yeah. You know,
the cover is being taken away.
Right. Either you would inadvertently shoot a rocket into the wall and the wall's now gone, or meanwhile, the gunship is blowing everything up around you and the floor you know, blows up in sections. The walls of the attic blow up, so you get less and less cover, but it's also easier for you to hit the gunship then with your rockets. So
yep.
It's a nice balance, and I thought putting the rocket supply crate upstairs was a really brilliant move, because that discouraged people from just camping on the bottom and waiting for a clear open shot.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I thought that whole setup of a very familiar enemy, again, with maybe a little different twist on things, was a great highlight to this chapter.
Mm. And that's a theme that's coming across a few times here. They've taken something and they've changed it. And we think we know how it works, but if you put it in a different environment, it perhaps works differently. I mean, you mentioned the antlion earlier on. We've been normally in quite an enclosed space, and it's just been one-on-one, whereas the battle earlier on was there were two of them, much bigger. There were antlions as well, plus there were combine.
Mm.
You know, and I think that's a theme that's coming across from our discussions, is using things in interesting ways that they didn't do in Half-Life 2. Not because they weren't very good at it, but there's only so much you can do in one game.
Right, and I think that was, you know, that was kind of their method of operation for episode one, in that they wanted to get it out the door quickly, which, you know, you could argue that they didn't, because it was nearly 2 years after Half-Life 2 came out, when they moved to this episodic release model, so to speak, and it was still a good, you know, 2 years or one, at least a year and a half between game releases. So that may not have been totally successful, but I think they took the step of, you know, they wanted episode two to be quite a bit different from what we had seen previously. So episode one had to kind of bridge the gap. So they started with what we knew the best from Half-Life 2. Used, you know, added a couple of seasonings there with the Zombine and you know, some new things that we haven't seen, but not too different. And then just combine them in interesting ways. Alex, you know, sniping to defend you, for example, rather than being sniped. And then they really had everything else pay off in episode two, where you get to see a lot of new stuff, relatively
speaking. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And then the end of this chapter finishes where you're kind of not stuck in the... It's not a hospital by any means, but it's some kind of medical facility. The doors blow, and then in come the Combine. Do you remember that particular section?
Yeah, and some of that, you're actually... The gunship is outside the window, kind of covering the window. So this is actually some of before the attic standoff, let's say. And I thought that part was well done, in that it kind of previews... You know you're going to be fighting the gunship in a few minutes anyway. And it's kind of hovering around on the right side as you make your way along this hallway. I was okay with this. This wasn't my favorite section of this. I really like the outside, more City 17 feel of things. I didn't mind the hospital area so much. It was a good combination of zombies and Combine, often fighting each other. But I almost thought this maybe should have taken place in as part of Low Life. You know, I thought it might have fit a little better there.
Perhaps, and it would have made it much more interesting. I mean, they almost put too much into this chapter.
Yeah.
I mean, when you think about all the things that happened in this chapter, gameplay-wise, not story-wise, but, you know, all the things that you did, it's way more than in any of the other chapters.
Yeah, it's much bigger. Right now, you look at our play times, and I think it's all over an hour.
I mean, the previous one for me was 19 minutes. This is nearly 1 hour 46 minutes.
Yeah.
Yours was 33 minutes to 1:14. I mean, it's a huge jump. But when you're playing it non-stop, it doesn't feel so separated. It only feels that separated because after each chapter, I stop because I do the screenshots and all of those things. If you play it through, maybe it's not so separate.
Hmm.
You know? Sorry.
I did like the mixture of a puzzle here and there in this chapter. The if I remember right, this is where the sort of explosive barrel room shows up. Right, you're crawling along the vent. The whole vent drops down, and then suddenly you freeze because you see trip mines at either end.
Yeah,
it was a little contrived, I thought, but it was a nice break from the otherwise, fairly intense combat here and there that we've been fighting.
Yeah, it was. And there's the puzzle. at the end, sorry, with the electricity underground.
That was the other one I was going to mention. Yeah, the sort of the flooded underground room there. Where you have to electrify things and then jump over them.
So. That was quite nice. So that brings us on to the final chapter, which is called Exit 17. Mm. Now, this has us reunited with Barney. Woohoo! And it does an interesting thing here because we have to escort the rebels. And I love that idea, but I hated the gameplay.
Really? Why is that?
Yeah, I don't know. I save the world, but not on an individual level.
You follow me? You're only fans of the saving the bigger picture. You don't want to save it.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. I mean, I love all of these rebels, and there's no reason for me to be there without them. But I didn't like going backwards and forwards, and I knew that it was going to get harder each time. And I thought it was really, really well done. And I'm complaining not there's anything wrong with it. I just didn't personally enjoy it. But I thought it was a really good idea.
See, I'm almost the opposite of you. I hear escort mission and my heart just sinks and I'm like, oh no, God. Because I've played how many mods and past games with terrible escort missions where you're the people accompanying you are just awful at life, and they can't make their way through barricades, they can't jump over it, that type of thing. I don't mean players, I mean non-player artificial intelligence, let's say. But this one I thought was actually pulled off really well. I'm not a big fan of the escort in general, but what I liked about this was that it reused the same environment over and over again with changes each time. So yes, it's going to get harder every time you escort a group, but I like how the train car collapses from the crane, midway through, and then your path has to change to get
change.
Yeah. And then every time you come outside, there's something new going on. There's the Combine soldiers are sometimes right in your face. And then there's a Combine vehicle shooting rockets at you. And I thought they could have gone a step further, and I'm glad they didn't, with like a helicopter or something. Gunship, let's say. So I thought it was fairly challenging, but it was in stages. In other words, you could take a break between them if you wanted. And it was only when you went to get the next group did things amp up again and sort of things get more intense.
Yes, yes. I agree with all of that. I do. I just didn't enjoy it.
Yeah, fair enough. No, I understand. Because I wasn't frustrated with this part, but it's not... It pales in comparison to the finale, which comes right after this, I think.
Yeah, I mean, my problem is I like to know how many times I've got to do something. I'm not sure if that's, my mentality, but it's like, okay, take these guys across. Okay, yeah, I can do that.
Oh, so yeah, okay, so if you knew you had to do it four times, each time is going to be like 25% harder, right? So
yeah, I mean, perhaps it was just how long have I got to do this for? That was the frustrating part.
Right.
But it was very well done. It leads us, once we've taken them all across, Barney gets on the train and we see him go off. Yeah. And this is perhaps one of my favorite section of all of the games so far.
Yeah, I still don't understand why we couldn't get on the train with Barney in the first place. Do they ever explain that?
Oh, that's a good point.
Besides you missing out on, of course, the big finale battle. But, I mean, still. I don't know. I'd have to replay that section to see if there was some excuse or other that we couldn't. I mean, the train certainly had plenty of room, but anyway.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've got a screenshot of Barney talking to Alex. I'm holding an AR-2, and probably there's like, okay, I'll get on this train, you wait for some more rebels or something, but yeah, it's like, he's gone, why can't I go with him?
I know.
You're right. And then the battle with the Strider, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. It's one of the things that I like. It's a quite an enclosed space. I mean, the actual area that you end up playing is very small. But they take you on a complicated route. You can eventually take some shortcuts and go back down and go back up. And then suddenly, when you think that you're just going to go around the corner, the Combine drop down from the ceiling. Or just like, oh my God, what's going on? And even one of my screenshots shows where I died.
The bright red one, yeah.
Yeah, the bright red one. So there's that. But I really did. I thought that was so well done.
Yeah, me too. And again, it's hard to avoid just kind of beating the dead horse. But it's a very familiar enemy. We've shot down how many Striders in Half-Life 2? At least 7 or 8, I would guess. Here it is again, but it's again different. And we see the same thing in Episode 2, to be honest. At the end of Episode 2. But
yep.
Here in Episode 1, we get sort of more or less a one-on-one. Yes, some Combine shows up, and there's some of those, not trip mines, what are the... Hopper mines in your way that are, so if you're rushing through, you're gonna hurt,
because
those will get you pretty quick. But
they
actually changed the artificial intelligence a little bit of the Strider for this, according to the developer's commentary, to slow down its reaction a little bit. So if you hit it with a rocket, it doesn't just automatically start shooting again. It actually takes a couple second break to give you a breather in there, because it is a very tight and closed space.
It is.
And thankfully, it doesn't use its big laser very much. It uses that mostly on the environment, and it starts to push it.
The first half as well.
Right.
I noticed that.
And it's sort of, again, we're back to sort of changing the environment as you go, which I was a big fan of in this case. At first, you're trapped. As soon as you open that gate and Alex goes through and the Strider shows up, you're trapped there for a few seconds until the Strider blows up one of the crates, and then that opens. You can run through and sort of proceed through the level.
Yeah.
But I really like that idea of a well-known enemy that we fought before in a slightly different environment with a different twist on it. It still led to probably the hardest on it for me and most intense battle of all the Half-Life games, because on hard, that Strider takes you down in a second or two if it gets a beat on you. And I had real trouble, especially with the ladder at the end, because you can run from spot to spot, in cover and stay in cover most of the time to avoid fire, but on that ladder, you're very exposed and you're slow. So it's very frustrating. But I didn't find it too frustrating. I thought this was a really fun battle, and I admit in my commentary there, my write-up on the post there, I think it got me a good 24 times at least to this. But that's what quick load and quick save are for. So
one of the things I think they did very well on this was they let you get to the same height as the Strider. Mm. And I'm not sure we'd had that opportunity before.
Well, we were on a rooftop in Half-Life 2 there, where you, before you make your way to the horse statue, if you remember that, so they were more or less in the distance, but there was an ammo rocket crate on the rooftop there. It was kind of a destroyed rooftop, so
you certainly weren't
as close as you were here. So
that's another thing. I mean, you really are up close and personal in some of these areas here.
So you really have to choose the moments where you shoot him with the rocket very carefully.
Yeah. Yeah, it was so well done, so well done. And that leads us on to the train, where, we've killed the Strider. Alex has, seen us, and she's so happy because we're here. And then off we go in the train, and it's like, yay! And then, of course, things don't go the way we planned, and we see all of the escape pods from the advisors.
Mm.
And they come past us, and as the train's going, we get hit. And I thought that was a really nice ending as well. I mean, it was... I enjoyed the ending here much more than I did in Half-Life 2. I don't know... I mean, you know that I wasn't a big fan of the ending in Half-Life 2. I had the sense that, I've really done a great job killing this Strider. I'm escaping, but obviously I know I'm not really going to escape. And it just sort of, as you said a few times before, it sets us so well up for Episode 2.
Yeah.
Which is the first game, really, that we've got a direct continuation from a previous game.
Yeah, and at the time we knew Episode 2 was in development, which was encouraging.
Yeah, when we wake up from Episode... when we wake up in Episode 2, it's not long after Episode 1. And I know that we wake up in Episode 1 not long after Half-Life 2, but you know, how did we get there? I mean, you mentioned that. How did we get to the bottom of the Citadel? Did we explode? You know, whereas here, we know what happens.
Right.
The train crashes and we wake up in the train. And that's a really good connection. I like that.
Yeah, I always love ending, you know, a map or a chapter with a big explosion. So I really like the end of this. And it's, I think, again, maybe the difference is that we knew episode two was in development and so-called coming soon, even though it was a good year and a half, I think, after episode one that we got the orange box. And, of course, we may have assumed the same about episode two, where it ended and... Yep. We expected episode three in a timely fashion, but the plans may have changed there, so who knows. But
exactly.
Yeah, no, I thought it was a really good way to... It gives you payoff. In other words, you've been shown the Citadel in trouble throughout the entire game, you know, from the opening view, once Dog gets out of your sight line there. You know, we save the Citadel, we see it throughout our battles in City 17, you know, and it looks a little worse and worse maybe as we go on. You finally get the payoff. You get to see it in its final moments. And things don't go quite the way you planned. You probably knew you never really were going to escape cleanly on a train anyway, right? But you see they set up for episode two very nicely. You see all the pods leave, and you know this transmission has gone out, which Alex has a copy of, and that's essentially your main mission in episode two is to return that to Dr. Kleiner and the guys. Yeah, to analyze and figure out what went wrong or what happened. So it's a very nice setup, and it's a little bit of a cliffhanger, but not nearly as much as Half-Life 2, I think, because we knew a follow-on was already in development.
We did, yeah, exactly. And you're right, just to finish with this, the Citadel, I mean, it's almost the very first thing we see, and it's almost the very last thing we see. You know, I mean, the first thing we see is Dog, but then he moves, and then we see the Citadel.
Right.
Here, we see the Citadel, then the car, and it's, you know, there's a nice sort of symmetry involved.
Yeah, nice bookends, and I think, you know, and then when we wake up in episode two, the scene has changed quite a bit. It's actually, you know, a bright blue day, and blue sky, and the Citadel isn't there, but it's still, you know, some semblance of it is still there, so...
Yeah, exactly. So, if you were Valve, what would you have done differently?
You know, I think, I wouldn't have changed that much looking back at it. I think maybe what may have gone a long way toward improving it is simply adding a new weapon or two. And it could have been as simple as one of the weapons in Deathmatch. In Half-Life 2 Deathmatch, you can get the Combine Energy Stick. You remember that the Metro Cop has and kind of swats you with. Yes, it's really just the same as a crowbar. You know, it's sort of just a melee weapon. But that type of thing, or maybe the Slam, which is kind of a combined satchel charge and trip mine sort of weapon. That I think that's more or less what the Combine use against you. You know, the red laser trip mines that you anything that breaks its kind of trip laser sets off the mine. Something like that may have gone a long way toward maybe adding a little more variety while not really having the commitment of a fully new game and new characters, new enemies, and everything else. Here we got a couple new enemies. We got the Zombine, and we got enemies used in very interesting ways, but we really didn't get any different weapons. No, it's not really a complaint, but it may be something that would have added to the experience a little bit.
Yeah, I agree, and I'm probably going to write an editorial about this, but in many ways, episode one reminds me so much of Blue Shift that there wasn't that much new. It was a good game in its own right, but people want new, and if you don't give it to them, some things just don't seem the same. And I think that I agree with you that if you'd have put a weapon or two, maybe some kind of new environment, I think balanced things out slightly. So, you know, going from what we thought was a horrible level, low life, to a fantastic level, urban flight, if there was a little bit more balance in there, I think people would have responded so much better to it than they did. I don't know. Maybe that's just me being hopeful. But I think it's clear that when they make a game, there has to be something new. And it probably needs to be at least one weapon, and at least one enemy. Because if not, even if you use things in interesting ways, it's not always enough.
Yeah, although it's, you know, it's a fine line to walk, though, because if you make, if you go toward the path of making too much new and different, then it won't feel like Half-Life, you know? So it's a fine balance that you'd have to walk. And I thought, you know, when I first played Episode 1, maybe they didn't do enough. Maybe you're right. Maybe something as simple as a couple weapons or a new environment would have done the trick. But looking at it now, it's hard to say that it's not an enjoyable game.
Yeah, that's the problem.
It is a lot like Blue Shift. It's short and sweet. You know, it maybe, I don't know what our accumulated play times were, but probably about 3 or 4 hours, I would guess, right? So
mine was 331, you were 322.
Okay, yeah, so say three and a half hours. But what's in there is really tight, you know, with the exception maybe of some of the sections in Low Life, which I wasn't a big fan of. There's not much dull areas. They mix puzzles and combat interestingly and enough to not get you fatigued on one or the other. Even when it's a puzzle-heavy chapter, like in the core, in the Citadel, there's still some combat to sort of offset that, and you even get some of the manhacks flying toward you at one point. You know, I thought it was mixed up very well, and it was just presented in a polished package.
Yeah, and the more we talk about it, and the more I look at the screenshots, the more I remember, this is a good game, and I really did enjoy it. But why is there a taste in my mouth?
I think it comes from comparing it against what's on either end. You know, you look at Half-Life 2, and you look at Episode 2, and there's no question that both of those are, you know, extraordinary games. And Episode 1 is pretty good. You know, if it weren't part of the Half-Life series, you know, maybe it would have been one of the best games ever released. But given that we're now comparing it against, you know, honestly, two of the best games ever released on either end here, it suffers a little bit in comparison.
Yeah. I mean, that was my point about the context.
Yeah.
It suffers from sort of where it is. But we did. I mean, a score from 10. We've never done it before, but we can do it for now. I'd have given this a 7, an 8, something like that.
Yeah, I would too. Yeah. Whereas the other games may be up in the 9s or 10s, but...
yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's the problem.
Yeah.
That they are fantastic, and this is just very, very good. Yeah. Okay, well, that's it. I enjoyed today. I liked how we went through the chapters. I think we covered more that way, because otherwise I forget too many things. I think that's my problem.
Yeah, I have one quick complaint now that we're wrapping up, and I should have gotten this way early, should have gotten this out of the way early on. Is, can I complain about the title of Half-Life Episode 1 and Episode 2? I think those are the worst titles you can possibly give episodes or games. I mean, the original name for this was Half-Life 2 Aftermath, right?
Aftermath, yeah.
So it made sense. It was literally the aftermath of what you did in Half-Life 2. When they call it Half-Life 2 Episode 1, that says to me it's the first episode of Half-Life 2.
It's before Episode
2. Right. You should have named it Half-Life 3 Episode 1.
Keep
with the aftermath. You know, Half-Life 2 Aftermath 1 and 2 and 3, whatever. It doesn't bother me that much, but it's just sort of one of those things that, in the back.
Yeah, no, it is. Especially since they seem to have publicly dropped the episodic model.
Right. Well, they certainly, it's not, even if they release Episode 3, the episodic model has been a failure, I can tell you that much, because it's been 6 years since we've seen Episode 2. And
absolutely.
You know, they are not releasing episodic games by any sense of the word.
So if you had to rename Episode 1, would you have stuck with Aftermath or Consequences, or I don't know, what would you have called it?
Something like Aftermath. Yeah, I'd have to put some thought into that, because actually, you know, and it's a pet peeve of mine, but titles are extraordinarily important to me.
I agree.
Mods or games or even chapters.
Chapters, yeah. Absolutely.
And Valve has generally done a great job of that, which surprised me that they would let this, you know, let this release as Half-Life 2 Episode 1, which doesn't make sense. But yeah, I would call it something like Aftermath, or you could even do a spin on maybe one of the Half-Life titles, Unforeseen Consequences, but they, of course, reuse that in Episode 2 a bit, so... Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to give. It'd be an interesting, interesting post or poll or something if those ever.
That's what I was about to say. Let the listeners, each of them, post their idea. If you have to rename episode one, what would you have called it? So with that, we'll finish. So thank you very much, Don. Really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you.
It was fun today. Thank you, listeners. By the time this is posted, the tree for episode two would have actually finished as well. So if you haven't caught up with that, catch up, because there'll be that to play. My plan is to do an episode two podcast as well, followed by a sort of a tree podcast. But I'm going away in a few days, and I'll be away for 3 weeks. So that might not happen until September. I know it's a big break from finishing the game to actually doing the final podcast, but I don't think I'll be able to do them when I'm in the UK. So my apologies to you and for the listeners for that. But we'll get round to it eventually. So thanks very much for listening. And remember, finishing Half-Life is just the beginning. Goodbye.
Bye.
Remember, finishing Half-Life is just the beginning.